Thank you for downloading this special edition of A Point of View after the vote from the BBC. The classicist Mary Beard gives her personal view of the UK's decision to leave the European Union.
A few days ago, I was one of a crowd of thousands in the ancient amphitheatre at Pompeii. It was the first time since AD 79 that an audience had gathered there to watch a show, not in this case a gladiatorial fight or a wild beast hunt, but a concert by David Gilmour, singer, guitarist and veteran of the rock band Pink Floyd. For me, it felt like a wonderful way, both of stepping into Roman history and of enjoying a belated triumph over Roman brutality. To be honest, we probably overestimate quite how bloody the games were at a backwoods little place like Pompeii. Gladiators were far too expensive a commodity to kill in large numbers in front of a local audience. But any traces of blood were now, for an evening at least, spectacularly obliterated by the fun, the fireworks and the very loud music. It wasn't actually the first time that Gilmour had appeared in this amphitheatre. In 1971, when Edward Heath was busy negotiating Britain's entry into the common market, he had played there with the rest of the band to make the famous movie Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii. But then it had been empty of all but the musicians, the cameras and the crew. Gilmour's repeat of that occasion, by sheer coincidence, a couple of weeks after Britain had voted itself out of the EU, was instead in front of a heaving crowd that seemed to encapsulate some of the intriguing cultural entanglements of the new Europe. There we were, a polyglot gathering of young and old from different European countries, all happily colonising one of the most striking ruins of an ancient European empire which had once colonised us. We were both sharing a memorable celebration and bringing our different experiences to the party and taking away different messages. When Gilmour belted out one of the Floyd's classic lines, "Hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way," the middle-aged British fans, me included, smiled at that wry joke, which was, I suspect, lost on most of the Italian teenagers. But given the timing, I couldn't help thinking about the new Europe that we British seem to be about to lose and about my own personal stake in that. My career as an academic can be measured against the history of the common market, the EEC and the EU. I left school in 1972, and over those last 40-something years, what I do, the context in which I do it, and how I define myself and my job has changed dramatically, taking a decidedly European turn and, without doubt, a turn for the better. What's most important here is the broader intellectual and cultural world of which British universities have become a part. I'm not just talking cash, though it's true that the consequences on UK research of the withdrawal of EU funding may be devastating. A bigger revolution has been going on. In a way that would have seemed inconceivable when I was doing my own degree, I now expect to find students from all over Europe in my classes. And some of my closest colleagues in my department in Cambridge come from Italy, Germany and Greece. And it's a two-way traffic, as our staff and students have come simply to assume that the continent, as we used to call it, as if it wasn't us, is as open to them as the UK is, open for conversation, for resources and for collaboration. This doesn't just add to the local colour. The mixture of cultures and languages, of educational backgrounds and different traditions of expertise has widened all our horizons and has changed how we think about our subject, our opportunities and even about the very nature of education itself. To put it another way, whereas back in the 1980s, I would have introduced myself as a British academic, maybe even an English one, I now also think of myself and call myself European. And I mean also. You don't give up feeling British when you start to feel European. One of the worst legacies of Norman Tebbit in his infamous cricket test was saddling us with the notion that cultural allegiance and sporting patriotism was an either-or kind of phenomenon. Who did British Indians support when it came to the test match, he asked. India or England? That told you all you needed to know about where these immigrants' loyalties lay. Of course, it didn't tell you anything of the kind. Cultural identity is much more nuanced, much more multiple, and it doesn't work like Tebbit tendentiously suggested. To go back to the amphitheatre for a moment, this is one of the things that the ancient Romans got right, insisting as they did that you could be both Roman and Spanish and British and so on. A person could, in their words, have more than one heart. In fact, one of my favourite characters from the ancient world made exactly that point on his tombstone. He was a rich man called Zoilos, who came from a small town in what is now Turkey, but had made his fortune hundreds of miles away in Rome itself. On his grand memorial back home, he had himself depicted twice, once in a Roman toga and once in his native costume. It's what we might call being culturally ambidextrous. And I suppose that's rather what I feel in the new Europe, when I tingle a bit to the strains of Ode to Joy, as I do to God Save the Queen. It's a complexity and an openness that is something to celebrate. But there's another, less optimistic side to it, and that comes down to the question of who exactly the beneficiaries of what I'm calling this new European culture have been. It's all very well for intellectuals to enjoy the new linguistic babel of their common rooms, or for students at elite universities to take advantage of the new horizons that come with cultural European collaboration, or even, let's face it, for relatively well-heeled Gilmore fans to take a plane to a concert in the ruins of Pompeii. But none of that means very much to the unemployed of, say, Boston, Lincolnshire. In cultural terms, in England at least, and I think Scotland may have done better, the new European project tended to be the project of those already privileged. And my hunch is that that's one big reason why the referendum went the way it did. Hardly any voter thought they could make head nor tail of the economic predictions. The specious propaganda about sovereignty, migration, and getting our country back became powerful because it spoke to those who weren't necessarily racist or xenophobic, but who didn't in any way feel European. It's asking a lot for people to vote to remain in the EU when Europe has always been a foreign country. Those of us who have been the beneficiaries of New Europe must face the uncomfortable fact that we are partly to blame for the vote going, in our terms, so badly wrong, because we didn't stop, or we didn't stop long enough, to think of those who were on the other side of the cultural divide, and we didn't work hard enough over the decades, not just over the months of the referendum campaign, to share the benefits of which we were so certain and so rightly proud. Succession of governments back to the 1970s has a lot to answer for too. When in a couple of hundred years' time, historians come to reflect on why Britain decided to quit the EU, they will, I'm sure, look in astonishment at how little those governments did to help us all think Europe. Cultural identity may be multiple, it may be nuanced, but it still needs working on. To me, it simply beggars belief that while the UK was entirely reformulating its relations with the rest of Europe, we were still happy that many, if not most, children in schools were fed a history curriculum that was built on British heroism against Europe, in which fighting Germans on the beaches and escape from Colditz were repeatedly presented as our finest hour. It even more beggars belief, as will no doubt be observed by those historians in the future, that over these last decades, we have let modern European languages in schools dangerously decline. German in particular has been in freefall, with 2016 marking its lowest ever GCSE entry. And maybe that's not wholly surprising. GCSEs put enormous emphasis on making yourself understood in a foreign language, which is fair enough. But as every canny teenager knows, speaking English slow and loud in a Colonel Blimpish way is likely to be a far better way of getting directions to the train station than your faltering German. Couldn't we have sold those languages more as a way of entering another culture, of opening our cultural eyes, and of being European? Some of the most eloquent Brexiteers have ready answers to the worries that I'm raising. They would point, for a start, to a variety of other cultural traditions outside the EU, and I would be the first to admit that students and colleagues from the Americas, Australia, and the Far East have also contributed to the diversity of the world in which I now work. But they would also say that you didn't necessarily need the EU to underpin the cultural collaboration I have been praising. Some upmarket Eurosceptics, as they never cease to remind us, are the biggest Europhiles of all. They have European wives, husbands and partners, and in some cases European second homes. I don't know how that plays in Boston links. And they love everything about Europe, from Mozart to Real Madrid, except any form of political integration, which they insist is not relevant to the cultural project. That has much more to do with the Channel Tunnel and cheap airfares than anything coming out of Brussels. I see what they mean, but I don't think they're right. Of course, Brexit will not spell the instant end to Euro collaboration. We won't all retreat to an unadulterated diet of Morris dancing any more than Switzerland outside the EU has remained a country of cuckoo clocks. Some of the intellectual exchanges will be too embedded to scrap. And anyway, the rich have always been able to spend their time soaking up the atmosphere at European universities. But for the rest of us, collaboration means institutional support and resources. We still don't know, for example, what will happen to the Erasmus scheme, which has so far supported more than 200,000 British students to work in the EU and its neighbours. The Erasmus website, understandably but unhelpfully, currently asks those who are anxious to be patient about the scheme's future. Definitive answers on the programme's future, particularly in relation to UK students and universities, may take time, it says. If you want to know, I'm pessimistic. I can't help thinking that what's left of my working life will see the intellectual boundaries we thought we'd broken down closing up again. And that is what I felt next to the pleasure of the occasion in the amphitheatre at Pompeii the other evening when I was listening to Gilmour rather attentively. Straight after the words about hanging on in the English way came the even more ominous line, "The time is gone, the song is over." Sitting where so many ancient Romans had sat before, I did start to wonder if the whole thing wasn't a bit of a requiem. The excitement of my own particular new European song perhaps really was over.
A Point of View After the Vote was written and presented by Mary Beard. The producer was Adele Armstrong. And you can find the other talks in this special series on the Radio 4 website.